Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Weekly Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting three comics that came out in shops last week, but that John and I got from DCBS this week. One from DC, one from Marvel, and one from some other publisher. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be discussing in this episode originally came out on July 23rd, 2008, and I am back home from the San Diego Comic-Con convention, Bob, as you well know, and like I'm sure you are, I'm a little behind on my reading.
Yeah, well, these all came out while we were in San Diego.
Yeah, I got 38 comics, I should say, one book, and I've got almost that many comics still piled up to read from last week and half the week before. So I've got a total of about 71 comics sitting in my to-read stack, and it's like, damn it, I just caught up.
Yeah, well, I got 41 comics, 5 hardcovers and trades, and 2 others, which are The Flash Companion and Modern Masters Volume 17 from Tomorrow's.
I got that Flash Companion.
You know, the one dark side to even getting them weekly from an online place is that, you know, these all came out in San Diego. So, for instance, Alex Robinson, I got Too Cool to Be Forgotten. That Alex Robinson, puts out like maybe one book a year, and it came out the week of San Diego, and I talked to him in San Diego, and he had the book, and it's like, well, I'm going to be getting it in the mail next week, so I couldn't get it autographed or anything. I didn't have the chance to read it and talk to him about the specific content in that book. The Scud Omnibus came out, same thing. That guy was there at the show. I saw him at the Image booth. But, you know, again, didn't have the opportunity to talk to him specifically about, you know, having had an opportunity to look at the material, which is too bad, you know, especially for infrequent things.
Well, I think for publishers that, you know, are trying to get that big item out or only do a few books a year, whatever, you know, in other words, not a Marvel, a DC, or other company that's publishing like clockwork, but for those more rare publications, in terms of frequency, they really ought to aim for like the week before San Diego.
Or any convention.
Or, yeah.
It should really, yeah, exactly. You know, the other good point to that is if it came out the week before a convention, then the dealers would have it and the dealers would be bringing it to the show with them. You know, frankly, a lot of dealers, you know, books come out on Wednesday. Well, Comic-Con was going on Wednesday, you know.
Yeah.
Unless they're like a local San Diego dealer, these guys are not going to be picking up their books and have them available at the show even. So you're right. They should be putting out their things that they want to be at any convention the week before that convention.
Well, and back when I was still living in San Diego, and this was, you know, 8-9 years ago, you would go there on, they still had the Wednesday preview night and stuff, and at that point, and it's not true now, at least not to the same degree, a lot of dealers would have, you know, the local ones, what came out that week. So the local comic shops were kind of getting, you know, hit kind of twice as hard because their customers were at the convention versus at their store picking up their weekly books. And sometimes those people would say, oh, wow, you know, here's this book here, and, you know, half the booths or whatever would seem to have it. So they'd pick it up there and then not get it at their local store just down the street.
Right.
So that stopped being an issue because I think not many people were carrying, you know, this week's comics. I'd be hard-pressed to name any booth that was carrying this week's comics, actually.
There were a couple. There were a couple over in the comic side, but they were mostly Marvel, DC kind of books. And even the shop that I used to go to, you know, the guy moved to Memphis, mm-hmm. You know, they still do conventions and stuff, and he has that other guy running the shop for him. They were there, but they didn't have any new comics. In years past, they used to have comics, and this time they just had, I mean, they had like 20 long boxes or so of half-off trades, and they had a lot of statues and busts and stuff. They didn't have any new comics anymore.
Hmm.
But there were a couple, but, you know, I was looking for instance, I was looking for the issue of Conan the Cimmerian that came out the previous week. the Frank Cho cover.
Right.
I ended up finding it at the Dark Horse booth, but there was not a single comics dealer that had it. They, you know, the ones that had it, they had, you know, maybe the popular Marvel and DC books. You know, like, there were a lot of places I saw that had X-Men 500. You know, you can find X-Men 500 and things like that, War Heroes, you know, at the Image booth, you know, but not as much. You know, you didn't have that many comics from this week. It's not really a new comic kind of thing.
Well, and one thing I want to toss out, and just since we're talking about, you know, new comic sales and stuff at conventions, is, of course, this is happening outside of the Diamond venue, so these are sales that are never going to show up in the numbers we look at every month. So, in some cases, it's not a huge percentage. In other cases, it is a huge percentage of sales.
Yeah, you're talking when the publisher's selling it directly to the fans.
Publisher or creators, yeah. So, because I know that there are a couple of, and we'll talk about this when we do our Comic-Con wrap-up episode. There are a couple of comics that I tend to get just at San Diego, either because they're not carried through Diamond, or they come out so rarely, or I discover them at con, stuff like that. So
yeah, it's true. I think a lot of those smaller end indies, you know, they probably sell a decent percentage of their copies at face-to-face venues like conventions and local shows and maybe even off their own website over the internet. And none of those are going to show up in the Diamond numbers, which, you know, I think the smaller a publisher, the more likely it is that the numbers that we have will be skewed a little bit because, you know, you sell a couple hundred copies, that makes a big difference on something that's selling 2,000. You know?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if Marvel hands out a couple hundred copies of Secret Invasion or something, you know, that's not going to make a dent in their overall number.
I tell you, though, some of the freebies that were getting handed out, and again, we'll talk about this in the San Diego wrap-up thing, probably had bigger circulations than a lot of mainstream Marvel and DC books. Just a lot of stuff there. But, well, shall we get into our first book of the week?
Brave and the Bold, number 15, with Nightwing and Hawkman.
What do you think of this one?
I like the story a lot. Well, Mark Waid's writing it. Personal preference, I don't want to make any black and white assessment here, but I am just not a huge fan of Scott Collins's art. It's just something about it is not, just doesn't hit me, and I just found it somewhat difficult to get through the issue. Especially coming off of George Perez doing the Brave and Bold series.
Well, and Jerry Ordway did an issue or two, didn't he?
Yeah, and those are both very classic, clean, crisp, nicely delineated styles, and Scott Collins has got that kind of scratchy, rendered kind of blocky kind of style.
There's something definitely different about his art style, and, you know, I'm having a hard time putting my finger on what it is, but it really, I'm having the same problem. It was a little harder to get into this issue than I think it should have been. Part of it is because of the way Mark Waid decided to start the issue. It almost felt like more of a start of a new story than the end of a existing story. But the art, there's something about Scott Collins' work. He's not a bad artist. He's not doing a bad job, but there's something about it that is different enough than most of the comics I'm reading that it's kind of a barrier to entry to the story for me, you know, and I can't put my finger on it. It's like, if this were a novel, it'd be like, I'm kind of liking the writing, but the font was the wrong choice, you know, is the best I can describe it. It's almost got a Kirby-esque quality in a few places to how he draws a few of the characters.
The faces for me, I just am not big on the faces. You know, Dead Man in particular, and I mean Dead Man, I mean, he's dead, right? Yeah. But something about the way that he did Dead Man, and when Green Arrow had been, you know, kind of beaten about the face, I mean, you're beaten about the face, but you're going to look like that? Jeez.
He looked like a troll. I didn't recognize Green Arrow when he first showed up.
He did look like a troll. And I don't care what kind of a beating that you get, you're not going to look like that. I mean, his head was twice as wide as his head should have been.
Yeah, it took a while for me to realize that that was Green Arrow.
Yeah, I mean, you can convey, you know, someone's messed up from taking a beating without making them look so different from what they look like that, you know, they're just completely unrecognizable. And that's the thing, you know, it's, I've seen other artists portray, you know, someone, you know, taking a beating, and you can tell that it's that character. They've just taken a beating, you know. It's just, I don't know. But I'm rambling at this point. I'm kind of like neutral on this series.
You know, I read an issue like this, and I'm thinking I can understand how the series has fallen in sales, from being up near the top of the charts to just being kind of a mid-list at best title for DC, which I think is unfortunate. Because, I mean, Mark Waid's a good writer. They've had some good artists on this series. I'm not going to include Scott Collins on that. I certainly don't think he's a horrible artist, but again, his art just isn't working for me. And again, personal preference on that. But this issue reminded me of something that a quote I'd read that J. Michael Straczynski had made apparently at the San Diego or the DC panel in San Diego about how, because he's going to be taking over Brave and the Bold, of how it takes place in an apartment right next to continuity, with the implication being it's not out of continuity, but it's not exactly in continuity. And there are parts of this issue that kind of felt that way. Now, part of that is kind of the return of Dead Man, which has kind of been, you know, in a nebulous state in the rest of the DC universe.
Well, they did that Vertigo Dead Man series that didn't seem to have, it was like a completely different Dead Man. It wasn't Boston brand at all.
Right.
So.
Well, and there was also some stuff in Batman and the Outsiders with other people doing the whole body possession thing that the Dead Man does, kind of implying that maybe Boston Brand has moved on, but clearly in this he hasn't. And Hawkman, you know, hasn't been doing a whole lot on Earth, at least that's jumping to my mind at the moment. So for him being a central figure here, now granted he was very well used and it made sense, it just felt a little off. And again, the mention of Trigon as, you know, the reason for getting the Titans, the Outsiders, and everybody else pretty much, you know, out of pocket doesn't really jive with what's going on in Titans at the moment. And in the whole bit of, you know, Nightwing being kind of the number two guy behind Superman that would be able to pull all these characters together, these teams together, and get them to go somewhere was cool, but it was almost a throwaway line, and I felt that could have been the core of a fairly interesting story in and of itself. So this was a decent resolution to the storyline. It had some fun moments, but I was left a little wanting, a little, I don't want to say disappointed, but it was a good comic when it could have been a great comic. And
when is Waid going to move off of Brave and the Bold?
I am not sure. It may be fairly soon. I don't know who's doing. I don't know who's doing the next issue. I'd have to go look at the solicitations.
I'm going to look at the solicit right now for Brave and the Bold. It looks like, well, at least issue 18, Marv Wolfman's writing. I don't know about. Well, that's a couple of months down the line, but so Waid's off of it by then. Now that's different. I don't know when Straczynski's supposed to take over.
I think they were just announcing that he's going to be taking it over at San Diego.
Okay.
And it also sounded like they were going to be adding in the Archie heroes, the Red Circle stuff that was previously used in the Impact line, and they were going to be kind of showing up in Brave and the Bold, kind of sort of reintroducing them or introducing them into the DC universe, but again, that comment about it being in an apartment next to continuity kind of worries me a little.
Yeah. I'm not convinced about that.
That just seems to be the same mistake Marvel made a couple of years back when continuity kind of fell out of fashion there and it got a little nebulous as to who was, you know, whose stories counted and didn't or whatever. Now, for some people, that may not make any difference whatsoever. And that's fine. If you're not a big fan of continuity, more power to you. But for somebody like me, and I assume it's the same for you, Bob, where I'm reading, you know, virtually every mainstream Marvel and DC Universe title out there. There's one or two on the Marvel side and DC side I'm not. But, I mean, 95 to 98% of the stuff I'm reading, when I see stuff that just flies in the face of other stories going on at the moment in mutually exclusive ways, it pulls me out of both stories.
Well, the reason I read Marvel and DC is because of the continuity in the universe. I mean, if I want to read a out-of-continuity superhero story, I'll read, you know, Invincible or something. You know, I don't need to read out-of-continuity, you know, Batman stories or something. You know, there are so many Batman stories being told. I don't really need to read another one.
Yeah, yeah. It just seems to me like continuity is something that can be used to really enhance a story in a very subtle manner. And again, when I see stuff like in Brave and the Bold, which kind of walks the line of is it in continuity or not, it makes me wonder about the strength of the editorial, which
right.
is sad because I know they've got some excellent editors over at DC. They've got some excellent creators. They have shown in the past they've got a solid marketing department too. DC has all the pieces in place to be doing excellent comics, marketing them effectively, and doing better in sales and just perception and stuff. At the moment, things aren't kind of clicking internally, at least from my outside perspective, for all that to be happening. But, you know, they had some interesting announcements in San Diego, both with where Brave and the Bold's going to be going and with the Milestone characters. So we'll see what happens.
You want to move on to our next book, X-Men 500?
Yeah.
Uncanny X-Men 500.
Definitely uncanny. And wow, 500, that's cool for them to have gotten that far. Which, you know, gee, no surprise, I mean, this is X-Men. But, you know, you got to realize for a while it was a reprint book. So how long have you've been getting on and off the X-Men books, though, right?
Well, I mean, I was on the X-Men books from 94 up until Claremont got extremely navel-gazy in the mid to late 200s somewhere, I think. I got off it when they went through the Siege Perilous up in Australia or some kind of nonsense like that, and nobody knew who they were, and I was like, oh, geez, I don't need... So I was off it for a really long time, and then I came back... A couple of times I tried to come back when Ed Brubaker was writing it with that Shi'ar stuff, but then it was like out in space and I didn't care that much for that. But then I got back onto it when they had that, what was the crossover called?
Messiah Complex.
Yeah, the Messiah Complex. So I'm back on it. I have since, you know, and I got back on most of the X books. I have since dropped several of them. I will be dropping Cable. 6 is my last issue of that. The X-Men Legacy, I just could not get into. That one's out the door. This one I'm still on. I mean, I'm one of the people who like Greg Land's art, and I like Terry Dodson also. I was a little... I don't know how they're going to handle this when it's like a normal size comic book, but I don't know what I was imagining. But when I was thinking that the art was by Terry Dodson and Greg Land, I was thinking maybe one of them will be penciling it and one of them would be inking it. And it's almost like they divvied up the pages and Dodson did half of them and Land did half of them because, you know, as I was reading this issue, some of the pages I'm looking at and it's like, wow, this is a Greg Land page. And I'm looking at another page and it's like, wow, this is a Terry Dodson page. I don't know if you had the same reaction, but it just kept kind of jumping back and forth between the two artist styles. There was not a consistent style throughout the issue.
You know, it's funny you mention that because there was something that was kind of not really working for me in the issue, but honestly, I hadn't really noticed the jumping between the two styles. I mean, flipping through it now, yeah, it's plain as day. Greg Land, Terry Dodson, etc. And they're similar enough yet different enough styles that particularly when you look at near the opening where you've got the chapter one on the right and the end of that, I guess, second prologue there on the left, that's the best juxtaposition of the two styles, I think. And it was one of those that, you know, I was in the story trying to, you know, follow along, enjoying it, whatever. But that's one of those things where they're kind of bumps in the road that if it had been one style throughout, probably would have worked better for me.
Well, it was interesting because, like, the prologue, the couple of prologues, that's Terry Dodson.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Chapter one is Greg Land.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter two, also Greg Land. Then you get the chapter three, and the first two pages, three pages of it, are very clearly Terry Dodson.
Yeah.
And then you turn the page to the fourth page of chapter three, and boom, you're Greg Land again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that storm image, that's definitely, you know, so you got two pages of Greg Land, and then you turn the page again, and you're back in Dodson land for two pages. Then you turn the page to chapter four,
back
you got
to
Greg
yeah.
Land for a couple of pages, you know. And then you have one page of Terry Dodson, and then the facing page looks like Greg Land. And it's just like it's jumping back and forth like that, and it's like it's somehow not working for me where I can like read an entire issue of Greg Land or an entire issue of Terry Dodson, and I'm, you know, just happy to be reading it, but just kind of jumping back and forth. It was bugging me.
Yeah, yeah. That was an interesting choice for them to make. I will give them credit for being able to bounce between artists like that and keep the story flow consistent. Certainly
yeah,
the style is off.
Yeah, that was very, you know, the storytelling did not suffer because of it, other than just the, you know, switching gears was bugging me, you know, somehow in reading it. But it's not like there were huge story continuity gaps or anything.
Yeah.
The script obviously was tight enough. I can't imagine this being anything other than relatively tightly scripted because it's a 500 issue. So Marvel will inevitably put out some kind of a director's cut of this with, you know, script. You know, so you'll be able to tell for sure. But this couldn't have been Marvel style where, you know, it's just like they give like a vague outline because there's no way the two artists would have meshed so well had this not been relatively tightly scripted. I did like the concept of making San Francisco kind of a haven for mutants. I liked the various epilogues that they had that are setting up what's going to be coming next. Now, the only thing I can say, I actually liked this. What will kill it for me is if they go back on their standard X-Men thing where the storyline they're setting up starts weaving between all the X titles, because I'm serious, I don't want to buy all the X titles, and if they start doing that, I'm dropping all of them.
No, that's understandable. I can totally see where you're coming from on that, but it's, I don't know, I like how they're doing the safe haven in San Francisco and stuff. I'd kind of thought they'd already sort of established that to a bit, yet this seemed to be kind of trying to I don't say lay the groundwork for it or whatever. But like the chapter one where it's they're seeing the mayor, introducing her to the headquarters and stuff like that, it was one that I felt should have lasted a bit longer, given us a better feeling for what this headquarters looks like and stuff. And there were a couple of things that were kind of, you know, alluded to, but surprisingly enough, not shown. You know, Angel saying, hey, you know, I found the best view of San Francisco I could find. Isn't it wonderful? And the mayor's like, yeah, it's great. Yeah, we don't see the damn view. You know, so there are a couple of places
I'm glad you mentioned that because I had that exact same thought when I was reading the issue, and I forgot about it until you mentioned it here. But, you know, he says that at the end of a page, welcome to San Francisco, X-Men. And, you know, he's talking about the great view, and there's an ad. And I expected to turn the page and just have this big one or two page spread of this beautiful view of San Francisco. And there was nothing. It's like, what? I felt kind of robbed on that. You know, it was like,
yeah.
It just seemed like they were setting themselves up and maybe they didn't want to go with the stereotypical or something, but I was waiting for that.
So there are a couple of places like that where it just it fell a little short. It was a good issue. It had some fun stuff. The whole move to San Francisco, I'm not totally sold either for or against on. It just seemed this seemed to be status quo for the X-Men, if you will. Hey, we've rebuilt the mansion. In this case, they've moved. Big deal. You know, not that much of a difference, frankly. You know, oh, Sentinels are back, you know, whatever. It just seemed like we've gone through these motions before. this looks to be an interesting start for the creative team. I hope, like you're saying, they don't go interweave against, you know, every other title and stuff. That's cool for an occasional crossover storyline, but if you do that on a regular basis, it gets old real quick. I just was left entertained but not wowed, and for an issue 500 where they're potentially going to be bringing in a lot more people, I think while this was well written and tightly written, it wasn't as good of a sales pitch for the X-Men as it could have been. Matter of fact, I'm not even sure how well some of these characters were really introduced in the story. There's kind of the expectation you know these people already. Now, for me, that's not a problem. I've been getting X-Men or Uncanny X-Men off the rack since about issue 187 or thereabouts. So, I mean, for me, I do know these characters. But between the shifting art styles, the action, and you know, almost, I don't want to say for the sake of action, because it was motivated, whatever, but there's kind of more going on than we're really clued in on, and it's definitely, again, setting up the new status quo for the X-Men, which frankly, again, isn't that different from the existing one.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it, but I did like the character that they have Magneto interacting with there, because it seems like that's how they're setting up bringing back a zillion mutants into the Marvel Universe.
Yes, that was interesting.
That character, if anybody, is going to be the one to do that.
Yeah, so...
Which cover did you get?
I got the Alex Ross one.
Yeah, that's the one I got, too.
One thing I want to mention real quick, if you go to... Where's the page? You know where the Secret Invasion Inhumans ad is? Flip the page after that. It's inside of Chapter 2. It's about a couple of pages before the staple.
Uh-huh, with Colossus.
Colossus getting thrown. I really like the bottom panel of that, and it's the kind of thing...
One with Angel?
It's got... You're looking at Magneto, and you're kind of looking through kind of two people. Off on the left is Angel there, and then off on the right is Nightcrawler's tail, and it's kind of the juxtaposition of the angel and the devil kind of symbology or whatever.
Oh, you're looking at the facing page, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, down at the bottom there.
Yeah, on the right-hand page, okay.
The right-hand page. And I'm like, that's kind of a cool little thing for them to have tossed in, you know. They've got a solid creative team here. I think they're off to a good start. I'm just wondering if it's going to be one that just, you know, in another issue or two knocks it out of the park, and I'm like, wow, this is the best run on X-Men we've had in a while. Or again, if it's going to be the same old, same old.
Yeah.
Definitely worth checking out, though. You know, if you're an existing X-Men fan, certainly. If you're one that gets kind of in and out of the mutant franchise, this may be a good jump on point.
We got next, War Heroes from Image. Mark Miller with art by Tony Harris, inked by Cliff Rathburn.
You know, the cover on this is nice and good, but the colors on the cover really do not pop. It's got kind of a muted feel to that. And I'm going to say that this was a little different than what I was expecting story-wise. It was a very interesting premise, and I'm curious to see where they go with it. But I don't know. I don't say I was left a little cold. It was one of those that this thing started so much real-world-ish and then dives straight into not even science fiction, but I'm going to go with fantasy, that it kind of pulled back on the believability and reality that I think they may be trying to go for. What was your take on it?
The basic premise of this series is that, you know, there have been some more vigorous terrorist attacks on the United States, and somehow, somewhere, and they don't really go into it, and maybe it'll get brought up, you know, later, but somebody invented some various pills that give you superpowers. Apparently there's a pill for super strength and a, you know, super speed and flying and a variety of other super pills. So, you know, you got to give the leap of faith that someone actually was able to create these pills. But they take these superpower pills and they give them to people in the army. So, you know, you're going over and you got, you know, all the soldiers flying out of a helicopter and, you know, picking up tanks and tossing them around and, you know, being invulnerable, I assume, to bullets and things like this. So this eradicates the recruitment problem because there's lots of people who will join the army just so they can get their hands on these superpower pills. But then, of course, you got the war protesters who don't like war anyway. And I think that they're going to have to go in this direction at some point, that if this kind of pill exists, there's no way it's going to stay just in the hands of the military.
Yeah.
Since these soldiers are wandering around with them, you know, and exhibiting superpowers while on home leave. So I'm going to imagine at some point, you know, bad guys are going to be getting, hey, this is basically, it's a war story now, but this is so close from turning into a superhero book, because there's no way that criminals are not going to get a hold of these pills and start going out and robbing banks and doing their crimes with it, at which point the police or somebody is essentially going to have to be superheroes, because then they'll get the pills to fight the criminals.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just got a whole, you know, bad guys versus good guys thing.
Well, the other thing I'm really expecting to see at some point is kind of that Hour Man bit where the clock runs out on them, because these pills are only effective for 24 hours.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those things, yeah, you're lifting that tank, but, you know, has it been, you know, 22 hours or 23 hours or 24 hours you're going on kind of deal.
Right.
You know, what got me was, again, like I said at the beginning of this, they're going so much on the whole war on terror. And for the first couple of pages, everything is building up to a very believable, if the war on terror went south and things got worse, believability. And then suddenly the magic pill comes in. It's like, it's just there. And like you said, you just have to accept it. And I'm willing to go with that.
Well, you know, another thing that bothered me here is, okay, page one, right? Mm-hmm. You got the, who we're supposed to assume, I guess, is an Arab terrorist, right? And he's got a bomb. And you look at the bottom center panel of the first page. What do you assume from the symbol that they've got on that bomb? Which, you know,
I'm thinking nuclear.
Right. Well, I don't know if Mark Miller has ever seen what an actual nuclear bomb does, but even a really tiny little nuclear bomb is going to do a lot more than blow up a building. And they show the Capitol building being blown up here. And then they show the White House two panels later.
But this guy was at the Lincoln Memorial, wasn't he?
No. Oh, yeah, I guess he was at the Lincoln Memorial. But, well, I mean, you've been to Washington, right?
Yeah, it's been a few years, though.
But the Lincoln Memorial is on one end of the mall. The Capitol building's on the other end of the mall.
And
they show the explosion. Actually, we're looking at what looks like the front of the Capitol building, which the Lincoln Memorial, from the point of view that we're at here, the Lincoln Memorial is behind us.
That was my point,
but
yeah.
The White House is off to the left, and it's only about a quarter of a mile away. But
yeah, so the whole thing would be gone.
My actual point is like any nuke that you set off in downtown Washington area would obliterate the entire District of Columbia and make it into a smoking crater. Okay? You would not have anything in the District of Columbia left at all. And I just – and they talk about, you know, the number of dead, and I don't want to get, you know, morbid about it, but, you know, it's like, you know, the numbers seem way low. You know, they talk about, you know, 2,500 Americans died in three separate chemical attacks, and they talk about a bomb on downtown Los Angeles killing 5,000 people. And you'd have to, any bomb of any decent size, you'd have to go out of your way to kill only 5,000 people in downtown LA. I just thought some of the real world parts of this were a little sloppy.
Well, and particularly post 9/11, you know, because we've seen, you know, just with an attack on one building, you know, the amount of devastation that could happen. So, I mean, I agree that it was underselling the devastation that probably should have happened, but at least they were trying to go with a real world logic to things up until they introduced the magic pill.
Yeah, which, again, I don't want to get too nitpicky about it. It's just, as I was reading it, knowing some of the stuff that I know.
Yeah.
One of my first jobs was working for some physicists who did research into the effects of nuclear weapons. So I spent a lot of time looking at actual films of nuclear tests from the 50s and stuff when I was in college. It just, it rang untrue for me, but I'm unusual in that respect. Most people, you know, nuke is something that you see in a Hollywood movie.
Yeah. You know? I will say that they did a fairly credible job of exploring the impact of kind of being the war hero coming home with the one guy, why other people would want to sign up, and kind of the impact on recruiting that these magic pills would have.
Well, the other thing that seemed interesting is they show the guy in the wheelchair who's going to be joining up so that he can pop a magic pill, and I'm assuming from this is that he'll be able to run and jump and fly around and not be in the wheelchair once he takes this pill, which again moves it out of the realm of, you know, any kind of established, you know, quote unquote fantasy science that I've ever seen before. You know, because if somebody's in a wheelchair, it's usually because there's something wrong with the transmission of messages from their brain to their legs, you know, a spinal cord injury or something. And giving you superpowers is not going to make you walk, you know. But, you know, again, I don't want to get too real world logic-y into it.
Well, the other thing that I found kind of funny, and it was done just for the visual, I'm sure, was when the war hero guy, who's already enlisted and has the powers, is leaving. He clearly has a flight pill and is taken off, and it literally knocks the socks or the shoes off the people standing next to him.
This is, I don't think you saw the movie Hancock. I saw the movie Hancock. This is exactly what happens when Hancock takes off.
Well, it seemed similar to kind of the effect they've used a time or two on Smallville, and to a lesser degree with the older Petrelli brother on Heroes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's Hollywoodish visual, which is really funny because they're trying to get the comic book thing in a comic book. You know what I mean?
One thing I don't really understand, again, I don't want to like get too scientific on this, and you know, if we got a listener out there who's more scientific than me, you know, feel free to write in and correct it. But if you take off really fast, you're going to leave a vacuum where you were, which the surrounding air would implode into. There would not be a backblast of wind moving outward from you, which, you know, that's maybe if you're like taking off with like a rocket assist where you've got like exhaust or something coming out. But I'm assuming that there's not exhaust flying out of some bodily orifice on this guy.
I hope not.
Just taking off really fast, which would not seem to have any basis in reality. Again, I'm getting too picky about this. But.
Well, I just question the intelligence of doing that kind of a takeoff or whatever right below crossing power lines.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, it's some fun stuff. It was a good setup. It's an interesting premise. You know, I'm willing to accept the magic pills and stuff. Hopefully they'll be used for more than just, hey, they exist. I'm really curious to see where this goes. I think it is a somewhat topical slant on kind of the World War II, you know, why didn't the heroes fight the Nazis question.
Right.
So if anything was a weak point in this, and yeah, we've kind of harped on a few things, I'm actually going to go with it being the coloring, which I felt was a bit kind of muted and flat. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't dynamic. And there were a couple of places where, again, trying to get that comic book hero into the war, it would have been nice for it to be a bit more dynamic. But definitely, I think, something worth checking out. And, you know, was a little different than I had expected, but very enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm kind of neutral on it. Most enjoyable part about it for me was Tony Harris's art. I'm really a big fan of Tony Harris. I'll buy this series just to see his art. I like him on Ex Machina and some other things that he has done. But the story's not Mark Miller's best effort, in my opinion.
Certainly not. And this was clearly the first chapter of a 6-chapter story. You know, I didn't feel like I'd gotten any resolution or major payoff in this, but taking it as a first chapter of a 6-part story, it was good. It was not great. It was not brilliant. But it at least was going in a different direction and covering different ground than a lot of comics are doing these days. So I got to give it some credit for that.
Yeah, kind of an inauspicious week for me. I'm kind of like neutral on all three of the books that we talked about.
Yeah, I can see that. Again, none of these were bad, but none of these were just, wow, this is something everybody should definitely be reading, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. I wanted to give a shout out to a really fun community on the web called Livewire World. I've been participating in some trivia contests out there that you can find at forum.livewireworld.com. And boy, there's some really difficult trivia questions. I have to think pretty hard. You know, and then there's some other fun games like that. And another thing that they're doing right now is a writing competition. And they have it promoed as, so you think you're a writer? Do you dream of one day writing comics and occasionally squirrel down ideas? Do you write scripts and plots and never do anything with them? Or do you simply have a passion for comics and would like to win some of the most amazing comics prizes imaginable? If so, then this competition is for you. Every week for 10 weeks, they'll be issuing a new challenge. There'll be multiple options, one comics related and one not. Entries are then published anonymously, at least until voting closes, and users of the Livewire World forums vote. The competitors who do the best over the course of the 10 weeks will win amazing prizes, including signed and personalized scripts, gift vouchers, graphic novels, and more. You don't have to enter every week, but the more weeks you enter, the better your chance of winning a prize at the end. And the top 8 finishing competitors will all win prizes. So if you want to win signed and personalized scripts of things like X-Men 200 or the new Mousy Duffy graphic novel, or maybe you just want to exercise your writing chops, go out and this is the place to do it. Go check out www.forum.livewireworld.com. Join us next week when we discuss JSA Annual Number 1 from DC, True Believers Number 1 from Marvel, and Jeddah She, Arrow of Destiny from MAW Productions.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.